The state is a product of society at a certain stage of development. It is the admission that this society has become entangled in an insoluble contradiction with itself, that it is split into irreconcilable antagonisms with which it is powerless to dispel. But in order that these antagonisms, these classes with conflicting economic interests, might not consume themselves and society in fruitless struggle, it became necessary to have a power seemingly standing above society that would alleviate the conflict and keep it within the bounds of order. And this power, arisen out of society, but placing itself above it and alienating itself more from it, is the state. This was how revolutionary Frederick Engels described the state, in words which I think are just as true today as they are when he wrote them in 1884. Well, the previous talk in this Marxist Foundation's stream, I think very much established and discussed that class is the central divide in society, and that's the way you can understand our capitalist society today. But then this raises the question of how it is that the capitalist class, be it a very small minority of people in our society, are able to hold on to power and prevent the massive workers from simply taking back what is rightfully theirs. So the state is a vital institution that the capitalists have to maintain their rule and power over society. Now, whilst the state constantly presents itself as being fair and democratic and hovering above the class divisions in society, I want to argue that it is firmly an undemocratic institution and that it is firmly on the side of the capitalist class. The role of the state, in the words of Marx, is to manage the common affairs of the bourgeoisie, the ruling class. So it is not an institution that can be taken over and used for the good of all, but it is in fact an obstacle to radical change. The capitalist state is an instrument of class rule and is precisely designed to maintain and uphold the wealth and power of the capitalist class and their system. So what is the state? The parliament, the police force, the army, the navy, the judiciary, the prison system, and the education system, some of its dominant institutions. And under capitalism, these arms of the state might help maintain the best environment possible for the bosses to exploit labour and to produce their profits. And for all the talk of democracy there is in Australia, with the exception of members of parliament and that of local councils, none of the heads or general positions in the state are even elected. So let's start to go through them. Well, a major aspect of the state apparatus is repression. And for that, the state has a monopoly on violence. The police force, the army and the navy are at its disposal to maintain law and order, so we're told. Now, there's a nauseating amount of TV shows that depict the police as being crime solvers and primarily concerned with the safety and well-being of everyone and everyone's property. Yet, I think this image is an absolute myth. That their seemingly benevolent activities, such as directing traffic, I think are merely a cover for a distraction away from what their real role is in society. And to be frank, as if you have to carry a gun to direct traffic anyway. Generally, I think traffic lights manage quite well without them. But the police exist primarily to protect property and the rich and to physically repress any challenge to the system. So police keep law and order, we're told. But whose law is it? Well, when we think that 90% of the law relates to property and that in Australia nearly half of the total wealth is owned by the top 10%, it becomes clear who the police actually protect. And in relation to most petty property crimes, the police are effectively just taxpayer-funded inspectors for insurance companies. Okay, so whose order is it? Well, you think, if Rupert Murdoch was to break into a shop and steal a TV, well, he would theoretically be charged with theft, and in the same way that I would be if I was to do that. However, I reckon he'd have weekend jail. Yet the rich have no need to do this at all. But when you think about it, Well, the capitalists steal every single day. That their profits come from the gulf between the wealth that workers produce and what they are paid in wages. And without this theft and exploitation, there can be no profits. Yet this is not considered theft by the police. This is just business, the order of the day. And the police are its loyal servants to uphold that order. So the harshest repression from the police is always against workers' strikes or demonstrations, which are met with these armed thugs of the state. So to physically enforce their rule, the capitalist class need to have a section of the population whose full-time job it is to do so. To have people that are separated as much as possible from the mass of ordinary people. To have special powers of surveillance. To arrest people. To have the rights to detain. To be disciplined. And to think that ordinary people are the problem in society. So endemic problems of corruption, I think, are an inevitable byproduct of giving police the power and the discretion they need to be a reliable means of enforcing class rule. However, this is a very small price to pay for an institution that is able to smash up picket lines, to break up demonstrations, to intimidate individuals, and to create moral panics about law and order. Now, in Melbourne at the moment, well, they're creating a moral panic at the moment about street violence. But when you think, they're silent to when you think about the violence that occurs every day in the workplace. That over 7,000 workers die every year as a direct result from workplace-related injuries and diseases. It's in fact the fifth biggest killer in Australia today. Yet the cops don't go on about the CEOs of companies having, you know, neglectful parents or, you know, decaying morals because, well, their job is not about policing ruling class behaviour. It's about controlling the working classes. Now, even the Victoria Police on their website has some very enlightening material in its history section when it brags about how police shot and killed 30 rebels during the Eureka Stockade. And then it goes on to say, the history of Victoria Police has been marked by World War I, the Depression period, followed by problems with unemployment, demonstrations and strikes, and then World War II. By the mid-60s, the population of Victoria passed 2 million, and police were trying to combat gambling issues, a developing youth culture, Vietnam War demonstrations. And then it ends with, throughout its existence, the organisation has remained true to its motto, uphold the right. So the police never come along to protests or demonstrations to hear both sides of the story. They come to bring the threat or the actual use of violence. So you think of the biggest mobilisation of police in decades was that for the APEC conference in Sydney in 2007, which many members of Socialist Alternative went and attended. The police spent $24 million every single day of their operation there. Because when the rich and powerful, you know, like George Bush and Vladimir Putin, come to town, the state spends our money to mobilise thousands of police on the street. You know, they spent money to buy a water cannon to parade around the streets, and they put snipers on the roofs of buildings ready to shoot people. Or at the recent demonstration here in Melbourne, against visiting former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert. You think the man responsible for the absolute destruction of Gaza and the murder of over 1,400 Palestinians in the war last year. Well, when he spoke, the police didn't rush into the hotel to go and arrest him for war crimes or, you know, for murder or for terrorism, but instead they pepper sprayed all of us who were out the front protesting against him. Now, the army and the Navy, well, they export this violence to other parts of the world. And in times of serious class struggle, they're used locally. You think when Gough Whitlam was sacked in 1975, army units were actually placed on standby in response to the mass working class demonstrations that followed. And if you actually look at the Australian Army's Manual of Land Warfare, it even includes guidelines for shooting agitators in crowds and the creation of concentration camps in Australia. So despite the sort of popular images of the like the police being friendly and nice, well, in fact, they're not a force for good in society, but an enemy of people who want to change the world. Okay, so let's look at the court system. Well, there's some figures like Bob Brown have claimed that Australia is the best legal system in the world. Whereas I want to argue it's the best legal system that money can buy. So for adequate representation in court, a good seniors counsel can be hired for about $550 per hour. You think you add to that solicitor's fees, court fees, the costs of gathering evidence, paying off expert witnesses, becomes a very costly affair. Now, this is a drop in the ocean for the rich who want to carry this through. Yet for working class people, this is almost impossible to afford. And it's this economic reality of justice that trumps the idea of the courts being fair and neutral. So when the Labor Party shamefully retained most of work choices, particularly the removal of protection from unfair dismissal, Julia Gillard had said, well, you can still take your employer to court if you feel you've been unfairly discriminated against. But an unfair termination case can cost up to $40,000 to pursue and can take up to 3 years. So for a worker to try to pursue this, you have to risk personal bankruptcy. If you have a house, you have to risk, you know, your house, almost everything that you own on this case. So everything is stacked against you. Whereas the employers, well, they can easily pay this this money, and they can drag out the proceedings for as long as they want. So the system's said to be fair and free of bias. Yet look at the judges. Like the heads of the police and the army, they're not elected, but they're appointed. They're appointed by the Governor General and the state governors, who are also unelected. Now, the judges are selected from the most successful lawyers, lawyers who mostly come from posh ruling class backgrounds, many of whom would have actually studied law right here at Melbourne University. But it's not just any lawyer that gets appointed to become a judge. You have to have a proven track record of being tough on petty crime, tough on immigrants, on trade unions, and soft on your friends in government and big business. And it's with the power and the privilege that judges have that they are certainly part of the ruling class and share in its common ideology and has the same interests as their peers. So let's look at the justice we've seen meted out in recent years. Look at the justice given to the directors of James Hardie. Because it was profitable, for decades, they subjected construction workers to handle asbestos, which to date has killed over 10,000 workers in Australia. And in fact, the deaths from asbestos is yet to even peak. But in the 1930s, James Hardie knew what the effects of asbestos were. They knew it was going to kill their workers, yet they continued to use this, this material anyway. Yet not a single director of James Hardie has ever been found guilty of murder. And in fact, except in the Australian Capital Territory, industrial manslaughter is not even considered a crime. It is not a law on the books. That the only penalty that the directors of James Hardie have ever received was last year, when some of them were fined for purposefully underfunding their own asbestos compensation fund. The biggest fine was $350,000. A drop in the ocean to these people. But you think, if anyone in this room here, you know, was to go out and murder one person, let alone 10,000 people, you would be in jail for the rest of your life. But if you're a company director earning millions and you do this, you get a slap on the wrist. That's what justice is under capitalism. But you think about the justice that's been delivered to Aboriginal people. That despite the entire history of dispossession and genocide of Aboriginal people, the first time in Australian history when a police officer was taken to court for murdering, for manslaughter of an Aboriginal person was in 2004, and that was Chris Hurley. An autopsy found the Palm Island man, Cameron Doomadgee, his liver had almost been cleaved in two from the extreme beatings that he received from Chris Hurley whilst in custody, and he was then left in a police cell to die. Now, despite the overwhelming evidence showing what Chris Hurley had done, An all-white jury found Hurley completely innocent of any wrongdoing. Hurley was later awarded compensation. He was given $100,000 for apparent lost property that occurred in the riots after the murder. And he, in fact, now has been promoted within the police force. So the justice given to this murderer has essentially been one of congratulation for murdering yet another Aboriginal person. Whilst Lex Wotton, who was one of many who rightfully rioted in Palm Island against this brutal murder, well, he's in jail. He's going to be there possibly for the next 4 years. And I think it's an utter indictment on the Australian legal system that not a single cop has ever been found guilty of murdering an Aboriginal person in this country. So the problem with the legal system is not that we have the wrong people in it, but its entire structure, from its laws that are 90% about defending property, to its judges that are hand-picked by the government from the upper echelons of society, and the absolute favouring of big capital and money over that of ordinary people. It's a system that is fundamentally flawed, and its image of being fair and completely neutral is a cover for its role of upholding the rights of property and big business. Okay, so I've explained how it is that the police and the legal system are undemocratic and rule for capital. Well, what about the parliament, which at the very least is elected? Well, in early capitalism, there was a genuine fear amongst some ruling class figures of giving the mass of workers the vote and having parliamentary democracy. So take, for instance, in the 19th century, the late British Lord Thomas Macaulay Babington, had said that universal suffrage would be fatal for all purposes for which government exists and is utterly incompatible with the existence of civilization. Now, bold words, but that capitalism, or indeed civilization, still exists, I think particularly show capitalism has been able to adapt very well to the mass of people having the right to vote. But this democracy and this parliament that we have and all its elected MPs, well, they're said to run the nation. But then the question comes, run it in whose interests? And to answer that, we have to look at who it is that actually has power in this society. That on a day-to-day level, most of the things that affect our lives, things like how much our rent is, what's the price of houses, the cost of food, interest rates, whether you have a job or not, how much you get paid, how long you get to work for. Well, these decisions, they're not made by Kevin Rudd. Well, they're chiefly made by completely unelected people, the heads of big business or the workings of the market. And the key issues that the government of the day is always concerned about, the sort of things which, you know, dominate the business sections of newspapers, you know, things like the levels of investment, inflation, unemployment, interest rates, you know, trade and budget deficits. Well, these are the result of a whole multitude of buying and selling, trading, and all these decisions that are chiefly made by big business. So the decisions that big business make can have a huge impact on society that pales in comparison to the individual decisions that we can make. So remember, as I said earlier, it's the top 10% in our society that controls nearly half of the wealth. So this is an immense power over society these people have. And the state is certainly not neutral to this massive imbalance of power. So understanding who has economic power is vital to understanding who has political power. And that is why democratically elected governments, whether they be Liberal or Labor, serve the rich and big business. It's not that they have the wrong ideas, but it's built into the foundations of the state, and it reflects a reality of capitalist society. It's the bosses that hold power, and it's the state that manages its common affairs. So that is why, in 2003, when the majority of people in Australia were opposed to the Iraq War, the government did it anyway and invaded. Or you think now, when the majority of people oppose the anti-union work choices laws, the Labor Party refuses to repeal these laws. And you can see this when Kevin Rudd was elected leader of the Labor Party, even before he was elected to become our Prime Minister, his priority was proving to business that he would be a suitable manager for capitalism. Within 2 months of him being appointed opposition leader, he publicly said that business leaders will have direct input to their policies. He even formed a new organisation called the Council of Business Advisors to give business leaders direct access to him as Prime Minister. But this is, in fact, not something that's unique to Kevin Rudd, but is demonstrative of a fact that all politicians and prime ministers know, that power lies with business, and that's who you're ruling for. And they also understand that if you don't meet the needs of capital, that there is the threat of the ruling class pulling out its investments from your country, crippling the economy, and thus their electoral prospects. And if you think that something like that would never happen here, again, you think about the coup that happened in 1975 against Whitlam, you know, when all the talk of, you know, democracy was just simply done away with. When Whitlam was sacked, he was simply overthrown, and Liberal Party leader Malcolm Fraser was just appointed to be Prime Minister. Now, all of that said, whilst elected officials serve the interests of capital and they're subservient to these, an ongoing movement from below can force concessions from the state. That an ongoing movement, I think, from predominantly workers can grant reforms. Yet these are still strictly within the limits of capitalism. And the fact that we have things like the right to vote, that we have the welfare state, we have your public health care, well, these things are a testament to that struggle that workers have carried out. Yet, like all things under capitalism, they're up for grabs. They can always be taken away. So despite everyone having the vote, Parliament is not a democracy. And like all the other institutions of the state, it serves the interest of capital. Now, the final aspect of the state I want to go through are some of its seemingly benevolent arms. That the state funds things like primary and secondary school education, domestic water, sewage system, healthcare system, roads, public transport, and others. Now, whilst these services are one that socialists certainly don't want to get rid of, in fact, you know, we want to expand these sort of services, but we need to understand what their role is under capitalism. That if it is that the state, its interest, is to manage the common affairs of the ruling class, it is in its common interests to have a continual stream of workers that are disciplined, that are educated up to a point, that are healthy enough to go to work each day and that can get to work on time. That is the driving motive for the state providing these services. But not only are they run to meet the needs of business, but increasingly a lot of these services are being privatised and are run directly for profit, you know, which has led to a decrease in the quality of these services, but also becoming more and more expensive for working class people to access. And the state also has this whole series of institutions that help manage the capitalist economy, that have a veneer of impartiality, such as the Productivity Commission, or the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, the ACCC. Now, the ACCC claims to promote a competition and fair trade in the marketplace. Now, whilst it occasionally issues, you know, product recalls of particular consumer products, or, you know, offers, you know, sort of, you know, dish out small fines to some companies who openly flaunt the law, when you look at their response to any major breaches of the law, I think it really shows you whose side these, you know, so-called watchdog organisations are on. Now, the largest fine that the ACCC have ever issued was to Richard Pratt, head of VisiBoard. In fact, this was the largest corporate fine that has ever been given in Australian history. Now, Richard Pratt was found guilty of price fixing, which earned him an extra $700 million. They fined him $36 million. And in court, he was even asked how much he thought he should have to pay back. Now, again, like, I'm sure if any of us was to go and steal $700 million, they would not ask you, oh, how much do you think you should pay back? You know, should it be all of it, just, you know, just a little bit? Well, they'd send you straight to jail and you have to pay all of it back. But if you're Richard Pratt, if you're someone that owns $5.4 billion and you do this, you get to walk away even richer. Okay, so to start to summarise, as I started with, the state constantly presents itself as being democratic and fair and neutral. But its practice is exactly the opposite. This is not simply a problem of having the wrong people in it, in its key positions, but rather its entire structure is undemocratic and is designed to serve the interests of capital. That the job of running the state is the job of running capitalism. So the capitalists need the state to enforce their rule. They need to have the parliament to have a facade of democracy. They need the courts to uphold their property rights and for the illusion of justice. They need the army to dominate and expand their influence outside the bounds of the nation state. And they need the police to physically enforce their rule at home. And behind all these institutions is the reality that the core division in society is between social classes, and the state exists to maintain the domination of this rich minority over the massive workers who produce all of their wealth. That the state apparatus guarantees the capitalists as little disruption as possible for business to exploit labour and to make their profits. So for anyone who does want to change society, the capitalist state should not be viewed as a force that can be taken over and used for the good of everyone. But it is an institution which needs to be smashed. That instead of reforming the state, we should set our sights on destroying the state and establishing a genuine democracy that gives the mass of workers who produce all the wealth in this society direct control over that.